So we began a study of the Exodus, and specifically chapter 12. And during the study, I mentioned that this book is written in the same effective way as a good novel would be written. It includes elements that most of us as readers are familiar with, such as foreshadowing of events, a summary of the action, and so on. In short, the story of the Exodus is a narrative account or a story. You can think of narrative as just being a story, and it's written in a way to grab our attention, and it grabs you from the very first chapter when we learn of what was happening in Egypt at that particular time, what was happening with the tribes of Israel, and what specifically we hone in on the example of one individual, Moses, whose life is saved. And then he enters the court of Pharaoh. It is a story for the ages. It is monumental. And I certainly encourage you in the next few weeks to read through the book of Exodus, and especially chapters 1 through 12, because it has all the elements of a great narrative, a great novel, a great story, but it's true. It has dynamic action. It has thunderous events. It has the personal story of success and sometimes failing. It's a fascinating read. From the story of Moses as an infant to his calling, it's riveting. And I guess that's why Cecil B. DeMille decided to make a movie out of it, which is one of the greatest of all time. I mean, despite some of the things that I have pointed out, which I think are kind of humorous flaws within the context of the movie, specifically the character of Edward G. Robinson playing a 1930s style gangster as Dathan. But besides that, and the same kind of voice that might be used by a 1930s Chicago gangster. But at any rate, the story flow of the entire book is chronological, of course, from first chapter to the last, but verse by verse, you have to understand that it's a narrative account, and sometimes there's a preview, sometimes there's a foreshadowing, and sometimes there's a summary of the events, just like you would find in a good book, and something that would keep you attentive to what is happening. For instance, let's take a look at Exodus chapter 3, and in verse 21, this is a foreshadowing as Moses is being called. It says, "And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians." And then there's a further preview of this specific event in Exodus chapter 11, as we covered last time. So it's a preview of action that is to come, and this preview is given to Moses to help encourage him in the mission, which is substantial, that he has to perform. Now, in a few short weeks, all of us here will begin the celebration of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And as we'll see in the message today, foundations are very important. And the introduction to something is very important to the foundation of God's laws. So today we'll review the instructions, the original instructions of Exodus 12, but then we'll move on to the historical events of the Passover throughout the Bible. It sounds like a lot to go through, and it sounds like a big undertaking at first, but you'll see that it's actually not that hard to do in a 40 to 50 minute message. But first, I want to start with helping you to understand the outline of Exodus 12. And you can take these down in your notes and refer to them. Double check on me if you want to. Go back and take a look. Is that really how it happened? Because there is a little outline that's helpful to understand the narrative account of Exodus as God's giving instruction to Moses. Moses is giving instruction to the leaders of Israel. And then Israel is actually fulfilling the instruction that God had given to them. So in verses 1 through 20, what we find are God's instruction to Moses and Aaron. So this helps us to frame the rest of that, the entire chapter, to understand that, okay, verses 1 through 20, God's speaking to Moses and Aaron. He's going to relay to his servants what he wants them to relay to the rest of the nation. In verses 21 through 27, we see Moses relaying those instructions then to the leaders and to all of the rest of the tribes, all of Israel. In verses 28 through 36, you see the narrative or the story account of the Passover and how it actually developed and how things actually went that particular beginning of that day, which, again, with all of us, I think we probably all have a little bit of difficulty with this, even though we've been in the church for a long time. We live in a society that is governed by a system that is Roman. It's not Hebraic. It's not like anything that is in the Bible. And we have to orient our minds into thinking that the day begins right after the day ends, which is at sunset. And so the new day begins in the dark, right? The new day begins at that particular time. You can ask God why I decided to do it that way, but I think it's a better way of doing it than beginning the day in the middle of the night at midnight, which is a different system. It's not God's system, but orienting your mind to thinking this way, okay, when we think of the 14th, the beginning of the 14th actually happened at sundown, the end of the previous day. And just as the days in the week have been appropriated, a lot of people think the first day of the week is Monday. They still think of Sunday as being a Sabbath of sorts. You know, you get the point. But on the calendars, at least they got that right, that Sunday is put as the first day of the week, and there's probably been efforts, and there will be efforts to change all of that. But verses 37 through 42, again, the narrative or the story account of then the departure from Egypt. So it's separate from the previous day. It's now going into talking about the story of them leaving Egypt, which takes place on the 15th, as we'll see. The Bible shows that. Verses 42 through 49 goes back to kind of the narrative account and includes a summary of additional instruction of the Passover for the future, things that would take place, you know, from now on. Summary instruction of additional instruction for the Passover for the future, what they should do. And you can read through that. We don't have time to read through the entire chapter today, but you can easily do that. And then verses 50 and 51, an acknowledgement of their obedience as they did it in that particular year, as the original instruction indicated they should. They followed through on the plan. Now let's go back to Exodus chapter 12 and verse 6. Exodus 12 and verse 6. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day, speaking of a lamb. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. So it is done by every household. This is very important to remember in the original instruction, which is a foundation for the rest of the time that, you know, that they would be God's people and for the rest of their lives. The whole assembly of the congregation shall kill it at twilight, at the beginning of the day. Between the evenings, as the New King James or the King James Version has, which means the time between sunset and actual complete dark. And there is a space, depending on the year and depending on the time of the year, space of about 30 to 60 minutes, maybe sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, that would be called twilight. Now, they were to do this in preparation. We know that they did it at twilight or the beginning of the day or between sundown and dark because at midnight, the death angel would be coming around, and if they didn't have that blood on the lintel of their homes, then they would be killed, just as the rest of the Egyptians would be, at least their firstborn. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. So they're coming into it. They're in a new month. They're approaching the middle of a new month. And at the 14th of that month, the beginning of it, they had a lot to do. They had to kill a sacrifice. They had to kill a lamb. They had to, maybe a lamb or a goat. They had to either keep it for their own family or to split it with another family. They had to roast it. They had to put it on the fire. And that, you know, they were experienced in doing it. I mean, it might take us a long time to do it if we're not experienced in doing it. But for them, probably took a couple of hours until the lamb would be maybe even approaching the time of being ready to eat. Small lamb, it would be roasted pretty quickly, but my guess, nobody says, nobody knows, nobody has said, okay, this is when they ate the Passover lamb. My guess, it might be around if, let's say, twilight is about 6 o'clock beginning in the evening. They might not be until 9 o'clock at night, till they were sitting down to actually have the meal, eating it in haste. And it says they ate it with unleavened bread. So they're to keep it until the 14th. Then the lamb was killed, as we see. Blood on the doorposts and on the lintels at home. Midnight, the death angel kills all the Egyptian firstborn. And so the 14th is Passover for a 24-hour period. It's a distinct day from the days of unleavened bread. But they did eat unleavened bread beginning that evening. And since they're about to leave Egypt, there's no time to really get into baking bread. So that day on the 14th, I don't know what they ate in the breakfast in the morning. I don't know what they had for lunch, if they had anything. They were getting ready. They were very busy. But it's very likely they only had unleavened bread available to them if they had anything at all. There was no time for leaven. Of course, we see that there's further instruction to get leaven out of their places, out of their abodes. So there wasn't any leaven by that time. But it was still the 14th. So you got the beginning of the 14th, which begins at sundown, sunset, however you want to put it, when it gets dark. And we're going all the way up till the 15th, and they're getting ready to plunder their neighbors and go out, and they get out. And you can read about that entire account in Exodus chapter 12. Of course, they were to keep two separate festivals, not just one, Passover, and then Days of Unleavened Bread. Numerous accounts in the Bible show us that. We have Exodus 12. We have other chapters in Exodus. We've got Leviticus 23. You see a clear separation. You see the times in which they are kept. But in Exodus 12 and verse 14, let's go back there. So this day God said to Moses and Aaron, shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations, and you shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. Which day? The 14th. Passover, a 24-hour day from twilight or from the beginning of the day until the next day. Now, moving on to Exodus 12 and verse 15, we read, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. But we're beginning something brand new here in this verse. On the first day, you shall remove leaven from your homes, for whoever eats leavened bread from that first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And we'll jump down to verse 18, where it says, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month at the evening, you shall eat unleavened bread. But obviously that's different than what would start the next day, because we'll see that. On the Passover, the 14th, we've already noted in verse 18 or verse 8 that they were to eat the Passover with unleavened bread. But then it goes on to say that until the 21st day of the month at evening, for 7 days no leavened bread shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he's a stranger or a native of the land. So the daytime portion of the 14th, as you'll read through the account, read through the story in Exodus 12, 2.5 million, 3 million people had to get ready to leave. There would really be no time for any leaven on the 14th or the 15th, so they were ready to go. So we see that there are 7 days of unleavened bread. And since the 7 days of unleavened bread end on the 21st, that is, in the evening at the end of the 21st, that would be the finality of the Days of Unleavened Bread, just in counting back 7 days From 21, we end up with 15. So the first day of unleavened bread would be the 15th, the second, the 16th, the third, the 17th, the fourth, the 18th, the fifth, the 19th, the sixth, the 20th, and the seventh day of unleavened bread would be the 21st. So here's some additional information that is background that is very important in understanding the flow of events, the chronology. I can put some charts up. I've got some charts. They don't really translate too well to a big audience or even on a PowerPoint, but you can make your own charts. But let's turn to Numbers chapter 33 and verse 3. Numbers 33 and verse 3. They departed. Who? Israel. They departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians. For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn. Well, that would be a task, right? We don't know exactly the population of Egypt. Probably in the millions, obviously. So if all the firstborn were killed, there'd be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of bodies to be buried. Whom the Lord had killed among them, also on their gods, the Lord had executed judgments in the previous nine plagues as well. Let's also note Leviticus 23 and verse 6, just for some background information. Leviticus 23 and verse 6. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. Now, the United Church of God, and probably most of the churches of God, may not make a, quote, religious statement on eating unleavened bread. I'll just give a personal opinion that I think I want to eat unleavened bread every day of the days of unleavened bread as a reminder, because that's all it is. It's a physical thing. Are you going to be ostracized, kicked out of the church, kicked out of the kingdom if you forget to eat unleavened bread one day? Well, obviously not. I mean, you can repent. Is it a sin? I mean, it would be a physical thing. But I think the more important thing is, if we're not trying to get leaven out of our lives every day, then we're falling short of the mark somehow or another. So it is kind of a physical thing, but you know, it was many years ago, over 30 years ago, there was such a lack of emphasis placed on this that, you know, people got to the point, well, you know, if I do, I do. If I don't, I don't. It doesn't really matter. The church is telling us it doesn't really matter all that much. And that church was. Those leaders were saying that. But I never went along with it. And so I'm just stating an opinion. I think it's a good thing to always eat unleavened bread during the days of unleavened bread. And thanks to Terry, she's gotten the good egg matzos, so we're not going to run out. You kids, you get your own matzos, okay? So they will. Just kidding. Okay, where were we? So Leviticus 23 and verse 6, 15th day of the month, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21, that gives you 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. And then let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 1. Now, I don't have time to really go through this chapter, but it's very interesting. And I'm not going to mention some of the potential controversies about it, but just taking the first verse, I think we can read it. Observe the month of Abib. It's the first month of the year. And keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. So you've got the Passover to be kept, and then the observance of the days of unleavened bread, which is really the basis of Deuteronomy 16 anyway. It's not the Passover that is the emphasis in this chapter. It's on the days of unleavened bread. But let's go back now to Exodus chapter 12. I'd like to cover now when Moses begins to give the instruction about the Passover for the first time to the elders, and that information would be translated to all the rest of the people. So in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 24, they were told, and you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. Now, forever is a long time. It's forever. I think we know what forever means. And it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. Now, it was called a service. This is called a service. The Passover is a service. But this service was one that was kept at home. Now, it really emphasizes the fact that the heads of the household were in that way responsible for doing some teaching. And it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what did you mean by this service? What is it all about? What's this time? What's this 14th, the beginning, sunset, twilight, whatever? What does all of this mean from the beginning of the day to the end? The whole 24-hour time period is Passover. It's a feast. It's a service. It's an acknowledgement of something tremendous that happened. Obviously, the Exodus. Obviously, the death of the Egyptian firstborn. And obviously, the protection and the Passover of God on all of those millions of Israelites and 12 tribes. So what do you mean by this service? That you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, because they, at the beginning of that day, after sacrificing the lamb, they had protected themselves by putting blood on the lintels and on the doorposts. When he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households, so the people bowed their heads and worshiped. They were brought to acknowledge God by this instruction. The instruction given to the entire nation was to keep the Passover as a service at home. And the emphasis on this family observance is specified by the instruction that when they came to the land that God would give, and when they questioned as to the meaning of this by their children, the parents would be able to explain it in an appropriate way. And when Joshua led them into the land, it's obvious that they retained the knowledge of that. But we're given very rare instances in the Bible when the Old Testament congregation even kept Passover. Now, it doesn't mean they didn't keep it every year, but we're just not given a lot of data points, okay? And I mean, if you're a numbers guy, some of you are numbers people, you like to have a lot of data points to establish something, and we're not given a lot. So we don't know about, I mean, we could assume that they obeyed for a number of years these instructions that were given in Exodus 12. And that might be accurate, but let's, for the moment, fast forward to the establishment of the nation under the kings of Saul and David and Solomon, you know, beginning around 1200 B.C. or 1100 B.C. or so, and follow that through to that particular time, because there's no mention of keeping the Passover until we're well into the reign of the kings of what is now a divided kingdom, designated as Samaria, or the northern kingdom, where 10 tribes were before they went into captivity, and then Judah, Benjamin, Levi in the south. Now, we're fast-forwarding hundreds of years, right? We're bypassing hundreds and hundreds of years of the judges. We're going past Joshua, where Joshua shows that they kept the Passover in that time. You can read about that in the first few chapters of Joshua as they enter into the land. But now there's no mention from that point on of the Passover until a long time later, a long time. So we don't have those touch points that we'd like to have. But with the ones that we do have, I think we can make some accurate deductions based on the history of both Israel and Judah. And the upshot is that we know this. Both of them were carried into captivity because of disobedience to God's law. Israel first, northern kingdom, and then Judah. So what does that tell us? Is that they had a difficult time, even the Jews, who at least retained an identity of themselves by an understanding of the Sabbath, although the number of observant Jews that actually keep the Sabbath today are probably a very small amount, but at least they identify with it, even though I don't know if you drove around to the synagogues today in Tucson, how much occupation would there be? What would they be doing? I mean, would they be present there? Who cares? I mean, but we're probably, as far as the participation level, even though it would be wrong, it'd probably be a very small minority, would be my guess. Of all, and I'm not passing judgment on anybody, just like I'm not passing judgment on Christians as well, or those who call themselves Christian. So we're fast-forwarding hundreds of years into the future, with no mention of Passover during the United Kingdom, Saul, David, Solomon. Chances are they probably kept it at some point. We just don't see it. But that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Now, we do know this, that the northern kingdom, or Samaria, had no righteous kings. You know, from the time of Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the split of the kingdom, no righteous kings at all. They immediately went into apostasy. They immediately began doing the things that they were warned about at the end of Joshua, by Joshua, and at the beginning of Judges, not to do. They didn't drive the people out. They amalgamated their religions into theirs, and they went into apostasy, and they're taken away to captivity. But the northern kingdom had no righteous kings, and Judah had a few. The next mention of the Passover, chronologically, that is actually kept by Judah, happens around 715 BC. Now, just for a reference point, the 10 tribes had already been carried away into captivity about 721 to 718 BC. We know that from our booklets, and we know that from history. So they were gone, for most of them. Some still remain, some were left behind. But we come to the reign of Hezekiah, who reigned from about 715 to 686 BC. And we find the account of Hezekiah's reforms in 2 Chronicles chapter 29, and you can read that chapter for yourself. Hezekiah's reign began in the first month, presumably Nisan Abib, the first month of the year, same one mentioned in Exodus 12. And because the temple had been neglected, it took at least a month to clean it and to consecrate it for the priesthood. So when you read chapters 29 and 30 of 2 Chronicles, they had already missed the first Passover. Because Hezekiah began his reign and then began these reforms, that first month, they didn't do it. They hadn't even really come to understand it. But chapter 30 begins, and we won't go to the chapter 30 yet, but chapter 30 shows the extent of their zeal and that they agreed to keep the second Passover, a precedent that is clearly established by the law of God. And it's important to note for the purpose of the message today, when a precedent is established by God himself. And when humans establish a precedence and do something on their own, I think that should be pretty obvious, right? So we find this precedent for, okay, now they discovered the law again. Hezekiah began instituting reforms. He began in such zealotry that probably the kind of fervor that people hadn't seen in a long time. But by the strength of his will and the fact that he was a king and ascended to the throne, he's now going to do things. So what do you do to make it right? Here's what they discovered. They discovered something from Numbers chapter 9. So let's go to Numbers chapter 9 and verse 6. Now this is going back now to Moses' time and back after the Exodus had already taken place. You follow? And they're in the wilderness and this situation came up. It's kind of like the situation that happened when these daughters didn't receive an inheritance. You remember that incident where daughters didn't receive an inheritance because the father had no son and everything, but they said, well, we deserve an inheritance, and God took the matter Moses took the matter to God, and he said, they're right. You should give them an inheritance, and they did. So this is a very similar thing. Now, there were certain men, verse 6 of Numbers 9, who were defiled by a human corpse, came in contact with a dead body, so that they could not, and this is a physical thing, right? Physically, they had to be concentrated, physically, they had to be clean, they didn't have the Holy Spirit, etc. So they could not keep the Passover on that day, and they came before Moses and Aaron that day, and those men said to him, we became defiled by a human corpse. So they're ceremonially unclean, so they couldn't partake of the Passover. Why are we kept from presenting the offering of the Lord at its appointed time among the children of Israel? And Moses said to them, stand still, that I may hear what the Lord will command concerning you. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your posterity is unclean because of a corpse or is far away on a journey, he may still keep the Lord's Passover. On the 14th day of the second month, at twilight, they may keep it. They shall eat it. They do it the same exact way, only a month later. Unleavened bread, bitter herbs, they shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break one of its bones. According to all the ordinances of the Passover, they shall keep it. Do it exactly alike, but on the 14th of the second month instead of the first. And you'll be good. But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and ceases to keep the Passover, that same person shall be cut off from among his people because he did not bring the offering of the Lord at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin. He'll be responsible. He had the instruction. He just didn't do it. Okay, in the same way, I mean, in this day and age, you could say, well, you know, hey, if you just had something better to do on the 14th of the month this year, I guess I would say, you know, maybe you should keep the second Passover, but if you just did it because of your own neglect, you know, you've sinned, okay? I'm not going to tell you you can't do it, but it should be because of extenuating circumstances. So we see a biblical precedent which is distinct from a human tradition. And that's why today, if somebody is sick and they can't attend the Passover service, we'll help set them up one way or another so they can keep the second Passover a month later. We've done that going back 80, 90 years, as far as I know. In Hezekiah's first Passover, we read at the beginning of 1 Chronicles 30 that he was so intent on instituting these reforms. Even though it was the second month, they couldn't do it because things were unclean in the temple, the priesthood was unclean, hadn't been sanctified, etc., etc., etc. Read about it in chapter 29. But in chapter 30, he was so intent on fulfilling this obligation of keeping the Passover feast that he wrote letters to the survivors of people who were of the other tribes in the northern kingdom and sent runners and sent letters to those who remained. And Ephraim and Manasseh and encouraged them to come to Jerusalem to keep the feast, which is magnificent and very thoughtful. And many people did respond at that time. They came to Jerusalem, and they were learning about the Passover now, believe it or not, for the first time in their lives, because it had been neglected. So let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 30 and verse 15. What do we find? Then they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day of the second month. The priests and the Levites were ashamed and sanctified themselves and brought the burnt offerings to the house of the Lord. They stood in their place according to their custom. This wasn't a Passover offering. This is just a sin offering. They stood in their place according to the custom, according to the law of Moses, the man of God. The priests sprinkled blood and received from the hand of the Levites. For there were many in the assembly who had not sanctified themselves. Therefore, the Levites had charge of the slaughter of the Passover lambs, a one-time exception of holding it within the household. For everyone who is not clean to sanctify them to the Lord, for the multitude of people, many from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, who had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover contrary to what was written. They did it wrong. Do you see that? They didn't do it in the right way. They were either unclean or they weren't doing it in their home. But aha, the king who is instituting these reforms prayed for them, saying, "May the good Lord provide atonement for everyone who prepares his heart to seek the Lord, the God of his fathers, though he is not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary." And guess what? The Lord listened to Hezekiah and healed the people. God forgave sin. What a concept. It wasn't perfect, but maybe it was 90% perfect or 95%, but it was 100% perfect from the heart. And if we know anything about God's relationship with David, he was looking at the heart, right? They didn't do everything right. It appears to be a hybrid of sorts, with individual families keeping the Passover and Passover lambs also being sacrificed by some of the priests. But we don't see an injunction from God to make that change from individual household to the priesthood. It is not there in the Bible. What we see is hundreds of years of neglect. And we'll see that in just a little bit. In fact, right now, in 640 BC, so we're now going now another 100 years, another century into the history of Judah, there was another righteous king who instituted very zealous reforms, and his name was Josiah. And he ascended to the throne when he was an old man of 8 years old. In about 632, at the age of 16, it says that he began to seek God. Incredible. God just, at certain points in history, reveals things to human beings. We read in 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and verse 3, "For in the eighth year of his reign," when he's 16, "when he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David, and in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah," when he's 20, "and Jerusalem of the high places, and the wooden images, and the carved images, and the molded images." This religious fervor and this reform would take a while because the nation had gone so far down. In about 622, or 10 years later, a priest by the name of Hilkiah found the book of the law, and we read about that in 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 14. "Now when they brought out the money that was brought into the house of the Lord," I'm picking it up in the middle of the story, you'll have to read the whole chapter yourself, "Hilkiah the priest found the book of the law of the Lord given by Moses." Here they're doing all this religious reform, and yet they hadn't found the law yet. Now they find it. You know, they found an unknown library or whatever. "Then Hilkiah answered and said to Shaphan the scribe, 'I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord.' And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan. And so Shaphan carried the book to the king, bringing the king word, saying, 'All that was committed to your servants, they are doing. And they have gathered the money that was found in the house of the Lord, and they've delivered it into the hand of the overseers and the workmen. Then Shaphan the scribe told the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. Now when the king realized that Judah had sinned, he inquired, you'll have to read the rest of this in the story, he inquired of a prophetess, and the prophetess did not mince words. She says, judgment has already been pronounced on Judah, but you know, you continue and do whatever you need to do, basically, and Josiah continued his reforms. In 1 Chronicles chapter 35, we read of yet another revival late in the history of Judah in its own land of keeping the Passover. In chapter 35 of verse 1, it says, Now Josiah kept a Passover to the Lord in Jerusalem, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day at the first month. Now, they got some parts of it right. Verse 7, drop down to verse 7. Then Josiah gave the lay people, that is, you know, the common folk, whatever, gave the lay people lambs and young goats from the flock for all Passover offerings for all who were present to the number of 30,000 as well as 3,000 cattle. These were from the king's possessions. You see two different offerings. One was a Passover offering, but the next one, cattle, that's not in the Passover. That would be for the next 7 days of unleavened bread. It obviously wasn't for the Passover sacrifice. It was for the days of unleavened bread sacrifice, but it just lumps it all together. But interesting that at least some people apparently were keeping the Passover in their own homes because the king gave the people lambs so that they could have that for Passover offerings. Verse 10, so the service was prepared and the priests stood in their places and the Levites in their divisions according to the king's command. And when they slaughtered the Passover offerings, the priests sprinkled the blood with their hands while the Levites skinned the animals. Then they removed the burnt offerings that they might give them to the divisions of the fathers' houses of the lay people to offer to the Lord as it is written in the book of Moses. That would be Exodus. And so they did with the cattle. That would be for the days of unleavened bread. And also they roasted the Passover offerings with fire according to the ordinance, but the other holy offerings they boiled in pots. And that would not be a Passover sacrifice. And actually, if you go back to Deuteronomy 16, those are the types of sacrifices that were offered there as you look at the Hebrew words, which we're not going into today. They're boiled in pots and cauldrons. The Passover sacrifice is never boiled. It was always roasted. And they divided them quickly among all the lay people. Verse 16. So all the service of the Lord was prepared the same day to keep the Passover and to offer burnt offerings on the altar of the Lord according to the command of King Josiah. So according to the command of the king. Now he was inspired, probably offering sacrifices for the sins of the people, but not as a Passover sacrifice. And we do see a hybridization of the law of God and then maybe giving some of this to the priest to do, even the Passover ordinance itself, instead of in the household. But it seems to be, once again, a hybrid that was born out of necessity because of the fact that they had not kept the Passover for, you know, now decades again. And so in trying to recapture what they had lost, the whole nation is doing this kind of hybrid celebration, but it was by the command of the king Josiah. He didn't, I mean, you could say his heart was right, but it's not an edict from God, you see. That's my main point there. But the children of Israel, verse 17, who were present, kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days. Again, you see the distinction of two separate feasts. There had been no Passover kept in Israel like that since the days of Samuel the prophet. Now we're going way back, even before the kingdom is united under a king. None of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as Josiah kept with the priests and the Levites and Judah and Israel who were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah. This Passover was kept. It may not have been perfect. They were rediscovering the law. We don't see a God-inspired precedent from the standpoint of God telling a priest or telling a prophetess or telling anybody. We see the action, which was sincere and motivated in the right way by the kings of Israel here in Josiah's case and in Hezekiah's case. But they had lost the knowledge of God because they hadn't been observant. And when they did come back, what they did was allowed. It's not condemned. But the command to keep the observance in the homes of the individuals was never changed at all. That's important to understand from a precedent standpoint. Now let's move further into the history of Israel. All this is very important as we move forward. The Passover of the Second Temple, because that's the next time in Bible history of the Old Testament we find the Passover being kept. Final mention chronologically of the restoration of the Passover. You see, there's times when, unless there were some rare few individuals that did it on their own, we don't see the record of the nation actually doing this. Despite these revivals, it fits in spurts throughout history. But chronologically, around 516 BC, at the completion of the Second Temple, this took place in the sixth year of King Darius of Persia. Once again, we find the Passover being kept in a slightly different manner, but the initial Exodus command was not changed in Scripture. And we pick up the story in Ezra chapter 6 and verse 19. Now, as you know, about less than 60,000 people came back from Babylon. Jews came back from Babylon, and they rebuilt the temple, the second temple. They came back after 70 years captivity in 536, and then another 20 years it took to complete the wall and the temple, and etc. We read that through Ezra and Nehemiah in several places, Malachi and others, and other Malachi's Haggai, I meant. But in verse 19, we read, the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. Beginning at the beginning. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves, all of them were ritually clean, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity. Now, why did they do it for everybody instead of just telling everybody, hey, do it in your homes? Again, because they hadn't done it in such a long time. Nobody knew what was going on. And there weren't lots of Bibles around to pass. Hey, read this. Here's a scroll. Read it. Go do it. They all get together, and they're all commanded to do something. So in this sense, again, it is not perfect, but they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for their brethren, the priests, and for themselves. And the children of Israel who had returned from the captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord God of Israel. They're doing a lot of things right, you see. But they hadn't had, being in Babylon, they hadn't been doing these things, just as we see in the other times. And they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy. For the Lord made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So, we cannot find a scriptural command, a God-inspired change to be made from individual household to that of priestly duty, but God allowed it during these times of revival, I presume, because the practice had been lost, and at least they were doing something. I believe an incorrect assumption has been made through the years that God somehow changed the way the Passover was to be observed from the original instruction. That is, it has been assumed that God just changed the keeping of the Passover from the household to the tabernacle in the wilderness and then to the temple. But all we're seeing in these few examples are the recovery of the people and their recovery of the understanding in some ways. And under the circumstances, it was better for them to have some kind of religious revival than none at all. But In these three separate circumstances, the Passover at least was kept, but it's interesting to note that in each one, the recovery of the nation of Judah begins with Passover observance, which shows why remembering this solemn occasion is so very important. Now, we tried to do it by the New Testament example, which we'll move to now as we conclude the sermon for today. But before I get to that, some may ask, why were the Jews of the first century, Some may ask, what were the Jews of the first century doing regarding the Passover? That is, when Christ appears upon the scene. Well, the only example that we have is Jesus keeping the Passover at the beginning of the day on the 14th, and that can be proven. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23, though, before we get to that proof, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23, Paul says, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.'" Jesus had instructed his disciples to prepare the Passover, and he said he would eat it with them, and he did. There was a traditional Passover meal. This is the example that we have that of what Jews were doing in the first century. Later in the day on the 14th, at the ninth hour, about 3 o'clock, as we know, Jesus was crucified and killed. Now, it has been theorized. I don't know if you can prove it or not. Maybe you can. It has been theorized that at that time, at the temple, lambs were being slaughtered during the daytime portion of the 14th. Now, that may be true, but it's not in the Bible. It could have happened. That has been the theory. But if you're looking for biblical evidence, you can't find it. But we could assume that it could be true. We just don't have a scriptural record of that event. But that theory and that assumption has led to other conclusions as well, which I don't want to go to myself. But we do have a record of Jesus keeping the Passover at the appointed time, the same time that he gave the instruction to Moses originally, the word, the same yesterday, today, and forever, who's mentioned in John 1 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So we do have a record of Jesus instructing his disciples to prepare the Passover, to keep it, and they had a typical dinner at that particular time, just like ancient Israel did with bitter herbs and lamb. Now, it was in a home, and it was in a rented home because they were all from Nazareth. They were from the north. But it was on that evening before his death that we see the record of law, not tradition, not just doing the best you can, but we see new law being given, or an amendment to the law, if you will. No longer would blood be needed to be splattered on the lintels of the door, symbolizing God's protection. In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 26, we read, "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body.' Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.'" The symbols of the new covenant would replace the sacrificial lamb and the blood on the lintels. So finally, almost every year this question comes up. And people will ask, why do the Jews keep the Passover a day later than we observe? Do you know the answer? The answer is, they don't. And it's not hard to understand why they don't observe the Passover. Oh, wait a minute. It says on my calendar, Mr. Buchanan, Passover. It's a day after we keep it. They don't keep Passover. Passover had already occurred the night before. Now, they may call it Passover, but they really have a dinner on the beginning of the 15th of Nisan Abib, the first month of the year. And like so many other generations of those who came out of Egypt in the Exodus, including all of the tribes, they lost the meaning of the Passover because it wasn't taught in the homes as originally prescribed. They only keep the time period of the days of unleavened bread. Now, whether that was their practice during the first century, I don't know. I don't know that you can prove it. But they don't even recognize the lamb as a sacrifice. It's just part of a meal. And since they don't accept Jesus as Messiah, it kind of makes sense as why they have forgotten the true meaning of Passover and Exodus. So observant Jews even don't keep Passover today, because at some point, even between the Testaments possibly, nobody really knows, but they amalgamated the celebration of the original Passover and the further celebration of the Days of Unleavened Bread into one seven-day festival, not beginning with the Passover, which included unleavened bread, as you can see from Exodus 12, but it's 7 days of unleavened bread later, a distinction that you should be able to make. And here's an additional proof regarding a prophecy, which is a lot to cover, but I'll just end with this. Because whatever day or year, rather, the final Passover with Jesus was, whether it was 30 AD or whether it was 31 AD, the beginning of that festival, that Passover, was a Wednesday, according to Roman time and days and dates. And we can pretty much prove that by prophecy. I don't know of any prophecy that has not ever been fulfilled. But the 14th of that year, 30, 31, some people even believe as late as 33, I don't know. But the point is that it was a Wednesday. And it had to be a Wednesday as Passover, because the next day was the day of unleavened bread. It was a high day. And that is why Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus went to claim the body of Jesus Christ so that they could finish putting him in the tomb before the high day would begin. And to fulfill the prophecy of Jesus being in the tomb 3 nights and 3 days, not parts of nights and days, Jesus went into the tomb at the end of that day and rose at the end of the weekly Sabbath day 72 hours later. Some people want to make a big deal out of it being exactly 72 hours. Blah, it probably was. But here's an additional point to leave with you. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 9. And verse 25, we're cutting into the middle of this monumental prophecy given to Daniel. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And you can do the day for a year principle and understand that. We'll cover that another time because it can be complex. No time to really cover it in complexity today. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times, going back to the times of Ezra and Nehemiah and showing how difficult even getting all of that done and even before that. Verse 26, and after 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself and the people of the prince, who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. 1 week, one prophetic week. But in the middle of the week, he will bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Jesus did that in the middle of the week with his sacrifice, which obliterated the need for all other sacrifices. So some feel, there's no biblical proof, but it doesn't really mean it didn't happen. Some feel that the priesthood of the first century were sacrificing lambs at the time that Jesus was crucified. And that may be true, although it's not mentioned in the Bible. But it's assumed that this was happening. But Jesus died at 3 p.m. And if those sacrifices were indeed happening at that particular time, God showed his disapproval of that which they were doing. Because what happened at that time was the veil was rent in two, Matthew 27 and verse 51, showing that the opportunity for man to approach God the Father in the Holy of Holies was now open, now accessible by the tearing of that temple veil. And there was also an earthquake which struck right at the temple. So if those Jews, thinking that they were offering sacrifices, if they were, and if they were doing, quote, the right thing by doing it throughout the end of the day and then having a cedar feast on the beginning of the 15th, well, it seems to me that an earthquake and a splitting of the veil and, you know, perhaps some buildings being rocked back and forth would have been a clear sign from God that, look, this is not my sacrifice. My sacrifice is over there in Golgotha. That's what I respect. Passover of the year Jesus was crucified was on a Wednesday, the middle of the week. The next day, the 15th, began the days of unleavened bread. For the Jews, the Passover became the title of this entire observance, and they stopped keeping Passover altogether. So they didn't keep it a day later. They just don't keep it at all. When we gather to keep the New Testament Passover, it's with the full assurance that the Church of God is reliant and observing it as Jesus taught his disciples.